No, thanks. This is Joni Stone on the 29th of September, 1986, interviewing Gustav Schwab V in his home in Sharon, Connecticut. Gus, as we were saying, how did you know about this area?
Well, for many, many years, my father came up here. He was an asthmatic, and they found one place in the world where the asthma didn't bother him. That was in Sharon and Mount Riley. I was to be brought up here as a kid, 9, 10 years old, and my mother and father would go up the mountain to their camp up there in Mount Riley. And I'd be left with my Aunt Laura Wheeler, who has been a resident for many, many years, where I would play in the apple blossoms of her place, which is numbers Home Lot 22, which is later bought by Jim Buckley and is the brick house across from Weatherstone on South Main Street. Next door neighbor was my Aunt Emmy Wheeler, who was very close to my, both were maiden aunts, but close to her sister. And they built the clock tower, which is, you may notice, it's dedicated to our beloved mother, who was my great-great-grandmother. And their name was Wheeler. And now, my grandmother's name was Wheeler also. This is where I come into the whole story. She married my grandfather, and their son was my father, and also there was a sister of my father's named Amo Herrick, who lived on Herrick Road. Anyway, I would be left with Aunt Laura, who was a wonderful old lady. She looked a little bit like General MacArthur, and she was a maiden aunt, and so was Aunt Emmy. And I would be left to play with them and be tutored by them while they were up the mountain enjoying themselves. This was now very much of a youngster in Sharon. It dates way back because there was another brother named William Ogden Wheeler, who was a bachelor. I seem to have a whole lot of bachelors and maiden aunts in my background. And William Ogden Wheeler was a great friend of Judge Warner's. And at one time, Judge Warner discovered that the bank in Salisbury had tax liens from the Ball Mountain Iron Works, which was defunct. And he bought up the entire acreage of 5,000 acres up on the mountain for tax liens, along with Major Tomlinson Wells from Litchfield. So there were three partners originally in Mount Riley. Now,
Gus, Judge who Warner?
Judge Donald Warner.
And he's the great-grandfather of our present, Don.
Donald, yeah, right. He was grandfather, not great-grandfather. This was back about 1896.
Oh.
And Judge Warner, whom everybody revered, he was a member of the state legislature. He was a very prominent citizen in Salisbury. And he noticed, as I just told you, that the Ball Mountain Iron Works was out of business, and the bank held tax liens for this 5,000 acres. And Judge Warner, with the help of Uncle Will Wheeler and Major Wells, picked up this acreage for a very insignificant sum.
Do you have any idea what that sum was?
But Don tells me that it was about 10 cents an acre.
Oh.
Well, that was right for that time, that particular time. The mountain at that time was practically denuded, because to try to go back a bit in history, the wood on the 5,000 acres was made into charcoal to fuel the blast furnace, which is still in existence up there in the mountain. And this they used for charcoal. As you go through the woods, you can see innumerable old charcoal hearths. A camp up there in the mountain, as a matter of fact, exists on one of them. And these charcoal hearths were manned on a 24-hour day basis.
Gus, what is that word you're using? Charcoal what?
Charcoal hearth. H-E-A-R-T-H.
Okay.
And this is making charcoal. They have to have these enormous things that are about the size of this house. And for weeks on end, they burn out the moisture and the various ingredients they don't want out of the wood, and they end up with pure charcoal, which burns at a very high heat, which is used for melting iron, which is what the whole purpose of it was. To give you a little idea about the name Riga, these charcoal burners came from Latvia, and they were here primarily to work off their indentures, which were their passage across the ocean from Latvia. And they stayed in the woods, as I say, for 24 hours a day, 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, to make the charcoal. And then they were paid, and then this way they were able to pay off their debts of that passage across the ocean. This goes quite far back, and going even further back, the mountain had quite a history, and before the revolution they were making iron up there, but not in this particular furnace, because it's much more modern than it was then during the Revolutionary War. They had a bootleg nail splitter up there because the British had a monopoly on making nails and matches, which is another story. But they had a bootleg nail splitter. They would cut his own nails, and people who wanted to build a house would go up there and buy these smuggled-in nails, or hand-manufactured nails. The area grew because of the water power, and because of the availability of labor, and because there was a place to pasture cattle, goats, sheep, and other things. You can still see the markings of the various householdings, I guess you might call them, where the stone walls would delineate the property that each one of them had. In the Revolutionary War, they made some wonderful things. The agate anchors for the frigate Constitution were made up there. Some of the chain that went across the Hudson has all the iron making areas around here, made some of the links that went across the Hudson River. All this was done with just mostly manual labor. Then along came the building of the main furnace, which was around 1830. And this particular edifice, they used the water power from the lake, and they built the dam, which is up there now, and provide the water power that worked the big bellows that produced the oxygen that went into the furnace. The charcoal burners were still busy. The town had about 1,000 people at one time up the main street. Their cellar holes are still evident. Around those cellar holes were fine lilacs and rhubarb, which was something that they planted for food and for decoration and protection. All through the whole area you'll find cellar holes, because the water power provided the energy for grist mills and for all sorts of the gun manufacturers were there. They made what is now called Kentucky rifles that were made in that Watch Castle Brook area, where there were lots of dams all the way down the mountain, most of them washed out. The furnace prospered for about 6 years, from 1830 to 1836. The thing had worked beautifully. The oil was brought up from the mines around Lakeville, in Salisbury, and the charcoal provided the fuel. The ore was necessary. The limestone came from Canaan, and the mixture provided the finest type of iron ore. The trip hammer that was also operated up there is now situated right in front of what was the old town hall at Salisbury. This was also operated by Wolcott. There was a trestle that went from the top of the present furnace, which has been restored but is there now, over to the hill nearby, and the oxen would back in the charcoal, limestone, and ore and dump it into the top of the furnace, and the resultant ore would be drawn out in a great big ladle. The slag was dumped over to the side, and you'll still find plenty of slag all over the mountain. They just reuse it now for making roads, but it's very good for making material. So it prospered for about 5 to 6 years. This Julian Petit was with us when we erected a historical stone commemorating this furnace. And her house, the house of the Iron Master, is still exists as notice and as cast note. And it overlooks the furnace and what was nearby. It's just like being a brewmaster. In making a beer, you have to have an iron master who knows how to mix the various ingredients. And as I say, that it was well known. They say that you could hear the roar of that furnace 5 miles away, because with the oxygen that was being poured into it, and with the charcoal, it must have looked like Pittsburgh. It was, as you say, there were 1,000 people up there. My mother used to say that the first silk dress ever seen in the state of Connecticut was up there. That they had military balls, and it was a gay place. And now, of course, it's just going to sell the whole. Now,
what I'd like to know, among other things, is, for instance, the Chapmans. Was she a Wells? Is that how the connection?
Jim Chapman. Jim Chapman was executive vice president of the Albany Bank, Frank McCabe was president of, or chairman of the board, and they were great friends. The McCabes have an area at the very top of the mountain where they have their own houses, the McCabe complex, and where Barbara Griggs is, and where Jim Chapman is, where it's all McCabe land. And so Jim is on one of the piece of Frank McCabe. He gave him seldom.
Oh, okay. Okay. So other than the Warners, the McCabes, the Wells, that's it.
Schwabs.
And what about Harris?
Harris? Which Harris?
Reese Harris's.
Well, they're tenants.
Okay.
They're in Castnook now.
Yeah.
Reese Harris's son owns
Bill.
Castnook.
Yeah.
We own the land under it.
Okay.
Our policy has always been to own land under a tenant's camp, and he has to maintain it. We don't have anything to do with maintenance of camps, thank goodness. This was Frank's McCabe's idea, and it has worked well. Because we can't go around maintaining camps. We don't have the staff to do it. We don't have the ability to do it. So we just collect ground rent.
You do, like Baltimore, Maryland. You pay ground rent.
I don't know about Baltimore, yeah.
When did people first start going up there for camps?
Well, as I say, it dates back to when Judge Warner.
He started it.
There were some people up there. There was a little farm that is now the Collins Camp.
Mm-hmm.
He had a couple of cows, and his name was Vicini. He was a Swiss guy. And before him, I don't know who it was, but there were several old characters like Ostrander and Jones. Davy Jones was his name. And Ostrander, he was still hanging in there. And His name was Davy Jones. Used to grow a beard during the winter, but summer he didn't have it there. And, this was the other way around. He, in the summer he had a beard, in the winter he didn't. And my mother said, "Dave, I said, why do you shave off that beard during the winter?" He says, "Freezes up, can't spit."
When you first started going up there as a child, was the store still there? Were there a lot of people still there?
Nothing.
By the time you started.
The scene was there.
Yeah.
I do remember meeting a stranger when I was a kid. Most everybody moved out. You see the remnants of the town were people that became inbred. And they began marrying their cousins and aunts and uncles and children and all this. And they got a little kind of crazy. And they were known as Raggy. And if anybody came up from down off, which is Salisbury or Lakeville, they'd flee into the woods and hide. And they were very strange people. They're all gone now. This is all here.
But their descendants certainly live on the way up.
Everybody's proud to be known as Raggy.
Yes, yes.
I think that Bud Bracey is very happy to be called a Raggy, and so is Eddie Bracey.
Yeah, yeah.
And these are descendants, as I understand it, of the original Raggies. When I used to go up there, there was only the farmer, Messini, was the only one that was around. And we used to stay at my father's camp, which he built and started. In about 1902, it was a college, finished up about 1910. And that's when my mother came along and insisted that a road be put through.
Well, how did you get there before that?
Well, I got in by rowboat.
From
the dam.
Oh, that road, yes. Oh, yes.
That was the town road. And they would row down the lake and bring their lumber in that way and their food and everything else. Sure. It was a little bit rougher than it is now.
When you are up there, you can take a path through the woods and you come out on a cliff that looks down over the valley north of Millerton and onto Route 22.
You know, that's what we call the Western Lookout. And when we were kids, we used to go out there and moonlight nights and then sit and watch the trains come down the Harlem Division of the New York Central. And the steam, called steam locomotives. The engineer would blow the whistle when he came to a crossing, which was a proper thing to do, of course. We'd see the steam go out, and then we'd count, because it would take so long for the sound to get to us up on the top of Westport. That was a lot of fun.
Was there a problem at one point about people buying the Kay Sisters farm? And perhaps access to come up to.
That was interesting. That goes way back. It was under contention between New York State and Connecticut. This is way back. And there was a strip of land which was never decided which state owned it. It's part of Boston Corners. And this is historic, that this is where the various miscreants and thieves and robbers and anybody that was being chased by the law could hide, because neither state had jurisdiction in that particular area. And this might come out as something interesting. Connecticut and New York decided to make a settlement. So for that strip of land, which is mostly scrub oak and ledges and there's nothing up there at all. It's on the edge of the mountain overlooking the Harlem Valley. They decided to make a swap. So Connecticut got what is now Greenwich and parts of Fairfield County. New York State got that scrub. So Connecticut obviously came out way ahead. That's where that little spur of Connecticut goes down into Greenwich that area came from. Became available to Mr. Kay some years ago, and he put a road up in there. And we used to know it as the enemy road because of this fight between Connecticut and the New York people. They were known as the enemy. And I really shouldn't continue that because they're all good friends now.
Did it originally go right up to the top, the road?
The K Road still goes and still being used by the people over there on the New York State side. Come up from the K Ranch and drive up that road, and it ends at the upper lake, we call it Mount Riger Lake, where some people have recently bought it in the last few years by the name of Leverskin, have a camp up there. They bought that piece from the K estate.
Okay. So the only way you can get in would be to know the people who bought the K Ranch.
That's right, because they have it gated off.
Yeah. Sure. And wasn't there a very, very well-known surgeon down at P&S?
Sure. Dr. Schlesinger. Ed Schlesinger. He has a camp.
Yeah, at the end of the lake.
I think he has on land, too. At the end of our lake, which is the lower.
Yeah, but that's not Riga land.
No, we don't own Ed's place because he has his own. Mm. But we own some land around there.
How many people now have camps up there, or how many
there,
camps
we have
are
16
there?
Tenants altogether.
That's all?
That's enough. The tenants, we own the land, they own the camp.
Yeah.
That's about it.
I'm counting in my mind just around where the Blackburn Road is.
Well, that was part of Frank McCabe's land.
That whole area?
Yeah. We provided, because we have 2 acres zoning, town of Salisbury. In order to make it legal for him to have a camp, we rented him another acre, which he added to an acre that Frank sold him. I don't know what the story was. Anyway, sure, we have to maintain roads. We have a security, of course, Teddy Gracie, who goes up there and takes care of things. He works hard, and he is our caretaker. So we do need some income to pay the taxes and do the maintenance of the roads and pay the security. Well, everybody knows, I think we were lucky enough to sell on each side of the Appalachian Trail from Massachusetts line to Lion's Head. To the federal government, which netted us a tidy sum, which we were then able to fix up the dam, which the state of Connecticut and the federal government Corps of Engineers decided that it was a hazardous dam. Mm-hmm. So we fixed that up, and it just recently passed inspection, so I think we're okay. It never has washed out. It's held since 1830 when it was built. We had a very serious hurricane 1955, and the water was going over the top of that dam 8 inches deep, clear across one end to the other, and washed out everything down below, but the dam held. So I think we're okay. We have to maintain that dam in the event of what the Corps of Engineers and the state call a Noah's flood, and this is what apparently we have been able to do.
Anything else of particular interest about Riga? You've done a great job.
Well, I might pass on to your readers or listeners, whoever they are. We have always had a lot of people who say, can I have a little place on Mount Riga? So we have extended the cemetery, the town cemetery. It's been up there for a couple hundred years. We've arranged for some land to go below it, and where you can get buried. And if somebody wants a little place in Mount Riga, we can sell them a 16 by 8 foot plot.